What a privilege, what a pleasure to be in Glasgow. My first time in Glasgow. I've been to the other side, to Edinburgh, but I've never been here. And how fortunate to be on this wonderful day. And I feel a little, I sort of feel a bit guilty keeping you here for this. But thank you for being here on this fine afternoon. And I was telling Andrew this morning that I feel a bit nervous, I must confess, because this is work very much in thinking, in work, you know, work in progress, because you know, to talk about the state of the Indian economy, to talk about the world economic, the global economic processes, etc., comes quite naturally to me now, you know, 30 years of being an economist. But to cross over into ethics and economics, and you know, and to think about bringing the two sides of my life, actually, because I am into ethics, into spirituality in a sort of a major way, is something which makes me, as I said, a bit bit nervous, because I don't know how does it feel to be on, you know, crossing over, as it were, the other side. I'll try, and I hope I can bring some thoughts to you and help think things along. But I mean, just to say also that what couldn't be a better place than Glasgow to talk about ethical economics. After all, this is a place where Adam Smith talked about, you know, philosophy, economics, and thought of economics as a part of political philosophy, as a part of the political economy. A thing which has sort of actually disappeared, unfortunately, over the last two or three centuries, because economics has become more and more, you know, has pretended to become a science, has pretended to become something which is devoid of human endeavor, you know, is above and beyond human control, as it were. You know, the laws of economics, as if these are inexorable, these are something that which is sort of, you know, keeps driving us along, and you know, there is just only one parameter to measure all everything in economics, which is growth, which is, you know, consumption, which is per capita incomes, etc., which I don't think was the thought that Adam Smith had. Adam Smith thought of economics much more as moral, you know, philosophy, much more as sort of something which explains, you know, why human beings, you know, do what they do and how they intervene in nature, etc. So perhaps, you know, Glasgow would be the place where I would start, you know, my structured thinking into this part of it. The talk that I have is divided into two parts. The first part, which I'll try and go over very quickly with you, is really just to establish the fact that we do need to think differently today. That it's not just, that there are very real circumstances that we are facing today which must force us to jettison the idea that, you know, this is going to be business as usual, and that, you know, all this is, you know, so just some facts I bring to you, you know, from the recent, you know, all that we've heard recently, just to prove that, you know, there are material circumstances in the world today for us to start thinking differently. And then the second part is the more substantive part, which is what I try to, where I try to sort of bring out a case as to, it sort of put some ideas forward in us, what are, you know, which is the way that we can think differently within economics, and what is the, and what are the sort of, you know, actions at the level of the individual and at the level of the corporate world that can be done or undertaken, which can take us in a different direction than what we have had so far. So that those are the two parts. And of course, I would very much welcome comments and discussion at the end, because as I said, it's really my work in progress, and therefore whatever your ideas would be would really help me a lot. So here it goes. This is the beginning, you know, and I sort of said three things that's happened today. You know, the Nicholas Stern report, the IPCC, this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and the, you know, and Gore's film that you must have all seen. And the Stern report now brings out very clearly, you know, that if we continue to do what we are doing, I mean, this just, you know, will take us down to a route where, you know, we would have done, and you know, sort of, we would have irreversibly harmed nature and the place we live for consequences that we just don't know anything about at the moment. And I think that is what, you know, and I think the material, the evidence that the Stern Committee report now gathers in one place, in, you know, in very sort of conservative ways. I mean, and I think there have been criticisms of it, but I think it's quite clear that the 50 years from now, 100 years from now, if we continue to do work and if we continue to act and behave the way we are doing, we are going to have a climate change, global warming, etc., the consequences of which are just completely unknown almost. But then some of the disasters we know already. I mean, there are some societies in Bangladesh, in Equatorial Africa, in the South Pacific Islands, which are going to suffer enormous damages. And I think the impact of that is going to be felt all over the world. So I think that's just, you know, the first, and I'm not going to get into the details of that, but I think those are very well known. The IPCC report, which came soon after, which was released in Paris, I think, about 4 months ago, brought out the fact that already we have seen about 0.8 degrees centigrade of warming over the last 50 years or so. And that what actions we have already taken, the inertial effects, that already we are on a higher, you know, sort of, you know, temperature, higher the global warming path, and therefore we will already, we've already entered the period where we would have changed nature in a sort of irreversible manner. The, you know, the seas are warming, the glaciers are shrinking, you know, the climate, the changes in, you know, in climate are impacting agriculture everywhere. Food security questions are coming up in, you know, in Africa, in Latin America, and, you know, there are urban chaos coming up. And so the IPCC, I think, even more than the Stern report, brought out the fact that we have already damaged the Earth to a certain extent, and unless we now reverse the damage to some extent, we are down a path which is a very dangerous and a very sort of path, as I said, of unknown consequences. And the same thing, you know, is done in the Gore's film, which I think for the first time will make even that most insular society very much open. And I think just this morning's, you know, the decision of the Supreme Court forcing the Environmental Protection Agency of the U.S. to rethink greenhouse emissions. And remember, the EPA in the U.S. had said that they don't want to do anything about the carbon emissions or the transport, you know, or the motor car emissions, simply because they didn't believe in the science, the evidence that had been collected so far. The Supreme Court this morning said, sorry, you've got to go back and, you know, rethink that, because the evidence that the Supreme Court thinks it has must now point in the direction that some action is necessary. And my personal belief is that for the first time in the U.S. history, a country which did not become a party to the Kyoto Protocol, the presidential elections, one of the issues could well be ecology. And that really will be great. I mean, that really will be a landmark situation where I think, but I suspect that the Democratic, the two parties and the two candidates will have to take sides in this debate for the first time. And that again, I think, will change the whole nature of this debate. And so if that's going to happen there, I think it's just as well for us that we also start taking part. And this is some of the facts that you have. I will not repeat them. I'll just take you through the slides for you to, you know, just sort of. But just please keep noticing India and China versus the US and the UK. Those are 2.3 billion people today at the levels that they are. They are going to be about 3.2 billion by the time there's 2040, 2050. India is supposed to stabilize at 1.7 billion. 1.65 billion, the population. China is supposed to stabilize at about 1.5, 1.55 billion. Now, and China stabilizes earlier than India. So you're talking about more than 3.1 or 2 billion people in 2050, not so far away from now, aspiring to be where the US and the UK are in some of these things. And just please keep that in mind, you know, as you think about what is in store for us if we do business as usual. And so those are the CO2 emissions. This is the emissions per capita. And I will like to be challenged in the UK figure. I asked my people if this was correct, and they have actually said yes. But as I said, please just have a look at that. This is water pollutants. Already China is there. This is kilograms per day. And this is what we are doing. These are absolute numbers, but try and look at them in comparative, in a comparative manner to see where we are, where the different countries are. This is kilograms workers per day in organic water pollutants. This is the total oil use in different countries. Notice that India is already about a fourth of the US total use, and China is about half. And given that of the US, and this is only the per capita income, so India is still about less than a tenth of the US consumption. So that with that total use already, a fourth, If we come anywhere near one half, one third, one fourth of the US, which is the aspirational levels, if you like, if you go according to the linear sort of development, the growth theory and so on, you can imagine what happens to the oil consumption and as a result the hydrocarbon and the and all of those things associated with it. This is the electricity consumption. India is about, where are we, 590, 600 as opposed to 14,000 per capita, and China is 1,400. Again, most of the electricity consumption generation comes from carbon, from coal or gas and things like that. Hydroelectric power is not so much available. Every energy study that you do tells you that if there is going to be more power, more electricity, it's got to come from hydrocarbon and burning of coal, and therefore you can well imagine the impact on the environment and the ecology if India and China go towards the per capita income levels that you, per capita consumptions that you have in the US and the UK. US and the UK being just used as a proxy for developed economies as a whole. You can use that for OECD economies, but the fact simply is that if the developing countries of the world, and India and China again are a proxy for the whole of the developing economies, you know, which is, and some of the developing economies are much lower, much below this, of course, you know, the Africans and the Southeast Asians and the South Asians. So you can see very clearly, I bring these facts to you simply to say that if there is business as usual, if India, China and the rest of the developing world are encouraged to become what the developed economies of the world today are, there simply is complete unsustainability written in our into our scenarios. There's just no way that this can happen, but there is no alternative way of thinking which has been given to them. Because everybody who talks about it just only talks about it in these terms, which is either per capita income or per capita consumptions or per capita, you know, use of electricity and steel and power and oil, etc., etc. So I think something's got to change if real immediate, I mean, real sort of, you know, disaster has got to be prevented, and all of this has got to, you know, we, all of us have to survive and in the near future. This is traditional fuel consumption. This basically means deforestation. Today, despite whatever, you see, this is the per capita oil use, this is the per capita energy consumption, and this is your traditional fuel consumption, which basically means fuel wood. And that just means that, you know, if 20% of India today, you know, uses fuel wood, and if this doesn't decline, you can well imagine what happens to your forest cover, etc. And that's GDP unit of energy. That's good news to a certain extent, which is that this is GDP per unit of energy. And that you can see that in India, we still manage to get a lot more output out of our energy than what you can, you know, what you would expect to get. And this is basically we are better energy users, given, you know, what we are and given what our economy is. And also this is true very much of other items as well, basically all steel, cement, etc. When you look at India's economy, you find that it's a more recycling economy than anywhere else you find in the developing or the developed world. Naturally so, than what you have in other parts of the world. And that's your annual fresh water withdrawals. The water is missing. Again, this is something that is rarely now. People are talking about, you know, water wars in certain parts of the world. Your groundwater is being depleted at an exceptionally rapid rate. Your aquifers are being polluted in most of the developing countries. And you'll find that there is water becomes a scarce commodity very soon in many parts of the world. So that's all about in ecology and different natural resources that I wanted to bring to you. Simply to say that that's a situation where if the developing countries went the same path as the developed economies today, it's just simply unsustainable. So you've got to do something. The next part is about poverty, is about underdevelopment. That you can't possibly deny, the central argument is here, that given what you have today in the developing world, you can't possibly deny to these people a future development and improvement of their living, you know, welfare. So this is life expectancy, which is not such a big difference. This is education index. We are far behind the India's. That's your adult literacy rate. And that's your under 5 mortality rate. And still, I mean, no, huge way to go as far as, you know, 85 to 5, 31 to 5. You know, that, you know, and that also shows the big difference between India and China, that China has done much better in social, in human development rather than, and also this comes up here too, 61 and 91, the adult literacy, that China has done very much better than India as far as literacy and, you know, basically human development is concerned, is much, China has done better because of its, you know, in past, you know, sort of socialist, economic, central planning sort of thing that they were achieving. This is poverty, living below poverty line. This is $1 a day. And, you know, that just simply means that people are earning about, you know, per capita $350 a day. That means a family earns, a five earns about $1,500 a year. That's what it shows, or $1,600 a year. And you can well imagine what that sort of life, you know, at that level, what is the quality of life that people have at that level. And those are the undernourished population. In India, again, 20%. And so this is the extent of poverty that you have. And this is still, in many ways, you will find that large parts of South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast, you know, and some parts of, if you like, Northern Africa, Central Asia today, parts of China, Southeast Asia, in Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos. I mean, these conditions are replicated in more places than one. I mean, the latest estimate, of course, is that you've got about $1.2 billion people living below a dollar a day. So poverty is a fact of life in India. So there is an unequal distribution of wealth in the world today, which just has to change again. So on the one hand, you have this huge amount, huge, large population waiting to improve, having where their living standard must be improved. But if they are improved the way it has been done in the past, you come into an unsustainable development paradigm. And that's the question that we have today facing us. So, what are the steps for?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The time is now 5 p.m. and the lighthouse dome has closed to the public. We would like to thank you for your visit and ask you to please to make your way to the front exit. Thank you.
Sorry about that. And these are some of the things that you heard very often, you know, about all this. You know, very often in India, especially in China, and I've been in Southeast Asia, people will just say, hey, this is all just too much hype. This is just, there's no truth in it. You know, who knows what's happening 50 years from now? And, you know, just forget it. Let's just get on with it. And, you know, this is the same old thing as the Club of Rome in the 1960s. You know, technology always has an answer. You know, this is just not, you know, this. And then in India, there are a large number of people who will say, this is not my problem, you know, because this is all what they did. You know, in America, US consumes 25% of the world's energy with, you know, with only, you know, 260 million people. So it's just them who has got to do all of that. And the same sort of saying, you know, with the same breath comes this argument that, you know, we have to raise our income levels anyway. What can we do with this level of poverty that we have with just $750 per capita in India? That's our income levels. Why are you talking to us in this manner? Why are you telling us all of this? It's not our, you know, this is our, it's our birthright today. And then the last one is that, you know, the retrofit, you know, which is that, you know, after all, what was Thames, you know what was Thames just after the Second World War, you know, the saying went that if you put your hand in, you came up without half your hand or, you know, without half your arm. But today there is trout there, you know, so it can be done. And there's just a cost. And you know, when we become rich, you know, we will do that. And I think today, without my, you know, I hope nobody minds it, but China is following that sort of a development policy. Chongqing, a city of about 30 million people, you can't breathe there today. I mean, there is just, it's just suffocating itself to death. I mean, I believe that there is one coal, 200 megawatt, you know, power generating power plant coming up in China every day. And that's the generation capacity that they are adding, all without clean coal technologies. You know, there are large parts of, you know, Chinese rivers system which are just completely now gone, you know, become, you know, out of use. You must have all heard of the disaster. I've seen it with my eyes, the Aral Sea in Central Asia and Kazakhstan. Half of the sea has just disappeared over the years because the Soviets built this huge canal out of the Amu Darya to make the cotton fields of Turkmenistan so that they don't have to depend upon cotton imports from the US. and then they will, you know, develop their own cotton, needed, by the way, only because the Soviet army needed cotton uniforms. So it was a strategic decision. So because the Soviet army needed cotton uniforms, they had to do, you know, grow their own cotton, which they could grow only in Turkmenistan, which is the desert. So they had to build the canal, which meant that Amudarya, half the water was drained off. So by the time the river reached the sea, it had disappeared into the sands, and today half the Aral Sea is gone. And you got the salts at the bottom of the sea being now dissipated in about a 1,000 mile radius through the winds, and may causing asthma and skin cancer in countries like Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan. So the question is that there is no retrofit for that. And there will be no retrofit for several other things like this when the glaciers take place. I'm giving you all of this to simply say that while you've heard these arguments in the past, and there might well be some truth in it, the fact today, as far as I'm concerned, is that business, just to repeat the sentence, that business as usual will not do. And this is, and I'm saying this because for us in India, it's a real genuine issue today. It's a real problem. This is an issue to be addressed by the development planners when they go about doing that, you know, their business of how to raise quadruple India's per capita income in the next 20 years and things like that, which is there's a debate which is at the moment started already. So for me, I have to, what I sort of put forward is that there is a case today for the shared responsibility for the global commons. And then the question simply is, the first thing I said, we can't take the chance. I mean, you know, it's just too risky. And there is no question. The probability, you can't just play on the probability game here, because the risks are just too high. And therefore, we have to change our view of the global commons. And we have to change our view of working together in this world. And TRIPS don't apply, meaning that whole business about intellectual property, that this is an intellectual property that's a private right for us in the area of saving your global commons, in the area of doing ecology, saving your ecology, in the area of saving this world which is our natural habitat, TRIPS just cannot apply. And we've got to develop a new thinking process together, of working together, of trying to develop new ideas, new technologies, new ways of doing things, which will raise this huge mass of poor people below, above that degraded form of living, which is just completely dehumanizing, and which will raise them above that level, and yet save our global commons and save our world from a sure disaster down which we are going. And this is where I say about shared developing country aspirations and costs of adopting new technologies, and which is that our countries, the Indias of the world, the Chinese of the world, must have to, you know, now innovate to try and, you know, while at the same time, you know, tackling poverty, raising people's living lives, you must have to innovate and develop new technologies. And where will these come from? These countries perhaps just don't have the resources to be able to do that. And so therefore, and this is really a part of that part of my talk, which is saying that we need universal global action in a shared manner. And therefore we need to develop some organizations, some fora, where people can talk about these issues and talk about how to take those steps together, rather than only talk about the, you know, the intellectual property protection, the individual rights, the right of the individual innovator. You've got to talk about some shared responsibility and a shared agenda between developing countries and the developed countries, which should become much more real, rather than thought of giving charity. It's not charity anymore. And therefore, I think, and the last line is just simply that, I mean, it's amazing for me to, you know, see that even after 30 years of the Cancun conference, the Nairobi Arusha conference, where the 0.7% was agreed to, we are far still, there's a lot long way to go. We're probably at 0.34% of aid. But if we divert this aid into innovative technologies to be developed with developing countries, rather than give them as a handout, you know, because of our sort of, you know, like bleeding heart situation, you know, that we just want to go out and do some more work and, you know, and remove poverty, so-called poverty reduction programs that all aid agencies today are doing, you know, which is whether it's DFID or USAID or the Swedish or the Scottish. Rather than that, if you use this money to develop and share, to develop new innovations, to, you know, to tackle this issue of this trade-off between income and ecology, between raising income in ecology, I think that we have much better use of that money than just to trying to fight poverty. The second part is what can be India's stance. And I think this is something that we need to do at home. We are debating this at this point in our country. And the first is, you know, I've repeated it very often, that, and I'm one of those who sort of trying to say that it's not about us and them anymore. It's not about putting blame on one or the other. It's about the, you know, matter of sharing the global commons. And that the costs of... The central thing is that today in countries like India, this whole thing sort of represents really an opportunity to develop leadership, to leapfrog technology. And that is, I think, what should be seized with both our hands today, is that we can develop new forms of doing things. I mean, you know, you can develop products which are less carbon using, which are developed, you know, I'll give you one example. We've done some work in Punjab Agricultural University on new ways to grow rice, which doesn't require standing water. Because standing water creates the largest amount of methane emissions that you have. So then the bacteria which develops, and that bacteria then generates the methane, which is a huge, you know, problem for the global warming. And this university has done 12 experiments, now being published in the latest agricultural science journals, where you can grow rice just as you grow potatoes on furrows and ridges, where you just run water thrice, you know, for irrigation, and the roots take up the water that is required, and you can grow rice without standing water. You can have huge carbon credits. Now the question is, who will provide the incentive for the farmers to adopt this new technology? You know, and how will this new technology be adopted, not just in India, but also in China? So that you save on groundwater, you save on methane emissions. So these are the new ways that you have to do things, you have to start doing things, if you want to. And I dare say, if you work that way, India, China and others could develop products which are ecologically more sensitive, ecologically more, you know, useful, and at the same time provide the same purposes. So this is where, this is my argument, I can now say, is I often make it to the companies and the investors who come to India, and almost as a challenge, so why not develop products which are of this nature, which you can then supply to the Indian market and make huge amounts of money, but then supply to other markets as well, rather than bring products which you're already using and, as it were, transferring from the developed economies to our economies, which will just have no such impact whatsoever. And India's unique situation needs new solutions, and that's more for my domestic audience. But the fact is that there is no other country in the world, and probably not even in human history, which has got such a pluralistic, diversified society. Trying to develop a market-based economy in a democratic setup, and with, you know, with a billion or more people, and in a sort of, you know, most sort of completely pluralistic, individual-based, you know, and to develop at the same time. I'm not sure whether you got an example before where you've had a sort of pluralistic, democratic, capitalist, market-based economy trying to modernize itself from basically, you know, in a situation where you've got population living in different centuries at the same time. And without the luxury of marginalizing or eliminating any set of your population, or controlling them in any sort of, you know, in that manner, with, you know, in an exploitative manner. And that's why India today needs completely different solutions. And I think this is where we need to, you know, in India we need to put our thinking caps on, but we need help in devising new solutions for our modernization, for our development. And I think that's where all this is coming to, you know, in some sense. I have looked at India's traditional thought in this respect, and that's where some of the more substantive points begin, which is that in India there's been, especially in the Hindu and the Buddhist tradition and the Jain traditions, also in Sikhism, if I've noticed, that there is, you know, this, what Marx talked about is the ultimate contradiction between man and nature, which is that man has to conquer nature for his own use, has been completely differently looked at in India, which is that man lives within nature. And man is a part of nature. And you know, this little phrase that I have at the bottom, which is Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, that the whole world, the whole nature is just one family. And we are a part of that. So that you have to nurture nature. And I'm saying this in the light that this is where you need the new solutions. How can human beings, how can man live within nature while nurturing it and yet improving his or her lifestyle and her well-being? And that's the challenge. And that, I think, in Indian situation, the whole practice of yajna and the havan and the sandhyas and so on, there's a whole shlok which sort of talks about peace be to everybody and peace be also to nature and to the herbs and so on. I think that's where some of these ideas can be found, and I bring this up simply to say that India will probably have to look very deep within its own traditions to find the solutions for its modernization. And that's, I think, is a good thought in any case, because that gives you the rootedness. And the second thing that we had in Indian thought is that needs are very different from your demands. And I think, and we must think about that a little bit more, which is that, you know, what does one need in terms of, you know, whichever way you like it, you know, in terms of survival, in terms of improving your living style, in terms of securing for your next generation a better lifestyle, in terms of, you know, thinking through what you need, what is the other way, in economic terms, let me put it this way, what constitutes your objective function, you know, and in what you have today from the Benthamite sort of economics is that there is a utility function, and the only component of that utility function is consumption, which comes from income, and there's nothing else. What the Indian thought would tell us is that no, consumption is just one finite part of it, and you just can't derive your utility, you can't derive your happiness only by maximizing consumption. Along with consumption, there are several other, you know, variables and components to that objective function. One would be community, the other would be collective action, the third would be nature, the fourth would be, you know, your own way of thinking, the meaning in life, etc. So if you do that, then needs become quite well defined, better defined, and they become very different from just demands. And you know, this whole notion then, and this is where I begin, this whole notion of economics being the dismal science of unlimited needs, demands, and limited means would begin to change. Because that's what you need today. But the question then is that, and this is where I discussed this with now my good friend Sir Mark Tully, and he brought this, the last point, the last bullet to me, which is that unfortunately greed intervenes. You know, and this is something that we also need to think through, which is that needs get transformed into demands and continuously keep getting extended because of the greed that you have within yourself. You know, and greed as a primal driving force of human behavior. Now, so this is where I think you need to rethink the ethical basis of economics. And what the simple concept there is that there has to be, therefore, an ethical basis for your need, because needs would have to be defined or have to be based on some ethical concept and the values that you've got. And that then brings to the fore the question as to whose value system that you will adopt. Why wouldn't there be a conflict between your value system and my value system? And could there be a universal value system or a universal set of ethics which then tells us that, which could replace consumption and utility and material consumption, which could replace this notion with a broader, much richer notion of your utility? And where would that derive from? And I think again, and this is something that we should discuss, because I have not thought through it, I've got some ideas on it, is that, you know, you need to then look at where these, you know, whether different religions can bring this forward, whether there is something beyond religion, which can be called some notions of, you know, universal spirituality, or there is some universal code of conduct that you can adopt that would then define to you a sort of set of ethics and set of values which will give you an objective function or a set of ethics which will make needs different from demand. And people could agree that this is where, you know, this is where the limits of our consumption would be. And this is a sort of very simple sort of thing, which means that why should one measure the progress of global economy only in terms of the growth of GDP? Why do economies which are already at $27,000, $25,000, $30,000 per capita need 3% growth of GDP as the only measure of their success? Why can't it be that, look, you know, that's enough, and that they can be stabilized at that level, and the employment that is to be generated can be generated in many different forms of enriching people's lives in ways other than just producing extra motor cars or more aeroplanes? And what could those be? And I think here we need to therefore look at things outside material consumption. And that is where I think some of our traditional practices, some of our traditional value systems, which very often we hear as children in our families, but we never get to see them implemented, would become far more useful than what we have got. The last bit that I wanted to say here is that some of us who are the better off will have to lead this. You know, we'll have to start, you know, we'll have to set the benchmark. We'll have to set the examples. Because it will be very unfair to talk about all these things to the poor today. But that's just not real. That's just not, you know, simply on. Because for them, the next meal is more important, however, wherever they get it from. So I think we, the ones, you know, who are better off either in the developing world or in the developed world, will have to start thinking about these things much more than expecting the poor to do so. And I think once we set the examples, because please remember that one of the two things that I brought out was the one, the environment and the world and the nature that we live in, but also the poor that you've got today. And I think today, if you are in India, one of the most dehumanizing things for yourself is when the poor child comes to your car and knocks at your closed window and it starts begging for you. But that's when you start questioning the whole thing as to where you are going and how can that form of, you know, development continue, this inequitable form of development continue. This is why I said poverty reduction is the highest priority, and this is one of the basic needs for the, you know, for the world as a whole. One of the most important needs would be this. And if then I just try to give a sort of idea which I have experienced myself as to how one defines one need, and which is to be able to act truly independently in connection with your own self, if you like. And this is where I said I was nervous, because in my experience I found that you can differentiate or distinguish between needs and demands once you connect with something within yourself and don't act reactively to what you need and what you want. Because I think what happens most of the time is that you are either demanding because you're wanting to keeping up with the Joneses, that everybody else has that, so why shouldn't I have that either, also. Or you are demanding simply because, you know, you one is fashion driven and the other, if you like, is just greed driven. And between the two, can we distinguish something else which comes from within, ourselves? And there, if you could connect with your own sort of, the only word I have is the inner self, maybe you could come with the notion that your needs are very different from just what the society tells you you need all the time. And this is, I just wanted to give my example of alcohol consumption. That at one stage in my life, when I thought, something which is what I don't like to do, there's a huge social pressure for me to continue to do so. And then I took for some reason I took this extreme step of saying that I will neither drink myself nor serve alcohol to anybody. And then that continued for a whole phase of my life. And then after that I realized that that is imposing my behavior on the others, and that was therefore not right. And therefore then shifted back to a situation where I don't drink, but I then offer drinks to the others because they should have the option to do so if they so like. And I give this example simply because I found this whole process of change within me through a very intense process of inner introspection, reflection, and as I say, connectedness within oneself. And this is what the word swatantra in in Sanskrit means, which is, you know, tantra means your instrument and swaha means yours. So once you are in connected to your own instrument from within, you begin to define your needs in a very different way than what the economics, what the material advertisers, you know, what the advertisement world, what the other, you know, the society as a whole will be able to tell you. So one of the ways the individual can go in the direction of not doing business as usual is in my submission is that if one was to connect within yourself, you would find the answers and not therefore be forced to continue with business as usual and be able to live much more, you know, sort of much more full, in a much more fulfilling manner and your life than what you do today. So rather than keep chasing mirages, rather than keep chasing demand which will never get fulfilled, which will never give you real sense of happiness or satisfaction, if you were to take a look within, if you were to get connected within, you will find that your needs will get better defined, your needs will be finite, your whatever you then demand will give you much greater satisfaction and will bring you into balance with your nature, and will bring you and will lead you to a path which will be ecologically sustainable and at the same time give you a quality of life which is much better than what you get by sheer material consumption. And I think that's the way we need to move today. And it's not as if this is completely unheard of. Many communities are doing that. You know, whether they are, you know, all kinds of faith-based communities all over the world are trying to practice some of this situation. And I've seen this in Myanmar with the Buddhists, I've seen it with Christians in Africa, I've seen it with Hindus in India, I've seen it with, you know, societies in, you know, Southeast Asia. But the problem is that none of this ever has even the remotest chance of being mainstreamed in any part of the world. And the thing is that why is it not our duty to try and mainstream these and start thinking a little more boldly, than to just accept the traditional economics as being a science of, you know, chasing unlimited demands with limited means that you've got. And I think that's the challenge that I bring before you today in my talk. These are some of the conclusions, and I just wanted to say here that while there is an individual form of action, which is to connect within, as it were, and to redefine your needs, the corporate world has the challenge that I mentioned before to develop the new technologies, that will help address the trade-off between ecology and income. And here I think the other two which I just wanted to bring out is that, you know, I say adopt new technologies that encourage shared use. And I just will give you where I start my thinking process on this. In India today, we have a very strong automobile lobby, which counts our success in number of cars that India produces every year. And we are very proud that we are today producing more than 1.5 million vehicles a year. And the auto lobby will tell us that we'll be producing 10 million down the road in the next 4 years, and then 20 again, and so on. And the thought to me is, can India survive with an individual automobile-based transport policy? I think the answer is a clear no. Think of 1.7 billion people trying to ride a car as they do in the US, one individual per car. Would we even have the surface area to give us enough roads? Is there any form of, any sense in following that sort of, you know, model, the development model? Then what's the development model that we have to follow? We've got to follow more shared use. We've got to develop much better, much more, the feeling of the global commons, of the public goods and, you know, public goods and service and delivery. Similarly, if you think of anything, if you think of modern health options, you know, the antibiotic based, you know, health option that you've got today, the amount of antibiotics and the biogenetics that you will have to conduct and, you know, to cure all the diseases that you might get, rather than to have a more, you know, scientific, more preventive based health sort of, you know, design and delivery system. You think of any aspect of life, you know, private education, you know, each child being given a private education in a very exclusive school, in the manner that you, you know, think about, you know, private education today. Is that a possibility? Is that something possible in India or in China today? You know, again, you would have to think in terms of much better delivery of public goods and services, you know, even in those fields. So my thought here is that the corporate world, the private sector, will have to develop technologies which encourage, you know, much more the shared use of your public goods and services, much more the shared, much more the collective use of whatever you have in nature today. And that's the big, and you can make money out of it. Or you have to develop technologies which will, you know, become, you know, which will actually, as it were, be much more ecologically friendly. And this is where the thought was about, you know, taking, leapfrogging the development paradigm that you have today. And I think, to, you know, what you have is, you know, things are developing in a manner that we have possibilities of that. There are new technologies that are coming up. And I think if we act collectively and together, we can address this issue of improving our lives and at the same time saving ecology. This is the end that I've come to my lecture. Thank you very much for listening to me.